certainly couldn't make them in any yield, but we set out to make a whole family of these.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned Bob Norman,
yeah,
that was giving at least a paper a month on the future of integrated circus and how it was just around the corner he pushed the thing forward a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we worked with direct couple technique that was simple to make, the simplest one to make, although not the most useful one for a circuit application.
Mm-hmm.
And facing up to the problem that here Fairchild's main customer was the circuit designer, and here we were giving them a design circuit, so the acceptance of integrated circuit was going to put these guys out of business.
Right.
And that didn't appeal to the sales department at all. But with the spectacular way that integrated circuits have changed our life, it's just hard to go back and say this was just a little backwater activity, and it interested me a lot, and it was of moderate interest to the other people there, but it wasn't looked on as something that was going to change the company at all.
What intrigued you about it so much?
I could see that if you could ever make these things, that it would have maybe a limited market, that would be a very exciting market.
Mm-hmm.
And the technical challenge of being able to make one was exciting to me.
Right.
And so we'd set up a whole family, and we were cranking out by October or so, in the hundreds of these things.
Mm-hmm. Per month.
Yeah. As a production process, you could see that this was etching through this wafer and taking off. I discussed this once with Charlie Spork and said, look, if we put this thing into production, what would you have done? And he made some appropriate Sporkian remark. So we were proceeding on that track, and
who were the customers at this time for these early circuits?
It would have been airborne missiles. It was okay. Just the same. The Minuteman people who were buying our transistors would have what price wasn't an object. Small space and usually when you get something small, it's a little more reliable. And you get rid of the vibration problems. And as it turned out, when the integrated circuit did go into production in larger quantities, about 63 or 64, the Minuteman was the first use of it.
Okay.
But so we were chugging along then. And then in late summer, early fall, the pre-production group had come up with a new way of dealing with boron diffusion that made it a lot more reproducible and easier to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And lying on Izzy, and there's a little difficulty sorting out who was doing what.
Mm-hmm.
Said, let's try to go back to this idea of diffusing through the wafer with this 18-hour diffusion. And it, to some extent, it worked.
Hmm.
So we could see that here we could electrically isolate devices, each in its own little well,
right,
by diffusing the whole wafer. And this was something that Lyle and Izzy just tried.
Right.
And it worked, as I said. But I have a memo that Gordon wrote in November of 59, in which he said, we want to start producing these devices, and it still is an open question whether we use the etch-through technique or the diffused isolation. So it was still an open question in October or November. And he said, if we have to make an arbitrary decision, we'll go now with the etched through the thing.
Mm.
So it wasn't, none of this was clear cut. And I don't know, I wasn't involved with why there was this pressure to make this a production device or not. That was something between Gordon and the rest of the company. Mm-hmm. The company was now getting very compartmentalized.
Mm.
You know,
because it was growing so large?
No, it was turning into a production thing, and
right.
different people took over. And people were shunted aside. You can ask why Gene Kleiner left, and that was the reason.
Oh, when did he leave? He left right around this time?
He left when I left, in the start of the next year.
Right. And he felt he was shunted aside?
Yeah, he had been running the production engineering group, and they brought in some hotshot from TI or someplace like that, and sort of put him in some side position. He just quit.
Hmm.
But that was, it's just inevitable in a big company, and starts to be run more by the organization person than the entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's just amazing when you look at it. No, it isn't amazing. It's just how few entrepreneurs end up running their company. From the venture capital point of view, the guy that started it, only 1 out of 10 ends up running it by the time it goes public. It's a pretty
sobering statistic.
It is, especially if you're the entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And the motivation is different. I'm certainly an entrepreneur, and I don't like the sort of organization problem you get into and building something up or setting up a quality control group or
right.
all that kind of stuff. So,
so this was, so it was in late 1960 that it was still an open question between the etch through and the Moron.
Well, we just made the first diffused ones about October or November, I think. October, November. I was very close to leaving by that point. And at that time, I took, I was not at all comfortable with this disappearance of this camaraderie and the filling group decisions and all this. And I was a couple of levels down from Noyce, and saw nothing of him. I had no concept of what the overall business decisions were.
Hmm.
And I said, I'm thinking I'll leave.
Hmm.
And the MIT people got a wind of this and said, would you like to consider coming here and being a professor? And they said, why don't you do this? He said, well, the Ford Foundation gives fellowships for short-term projects, and why don't you come back and give a series of lectures on transistor technology, number of weeks. So I did that in November, just while a lot of this other stuff was going on. I was, in steady contact with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a strong feeling I was going to be leaving. And so I went back, and I have to say it was quite an experience to go back and give this first lecture, and seeing all the professors that I'd left 2 years before sitting in the front row. Because I had done stuff that they didn't know anything about.
Right.
So that was an interesting period. But then I realized that this was an electrical engineering appointment.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the faculty meetings. And I said, just the way the decision-making process in the university, it would just, they would spend an hour discussing how you wrote a letter to somebody to invite him to a meeting.
Right.
I said, I'll just go nuts with this. So I said, you know, this certainly is not for me.
Mm.
And Von Hippel said, my advice to you is if you want an academic career, don't come in at this level. Wait until you've established your mark at something else and then come in as a professor. Or,
mm.
You know, don't have to put up with all this degrading crap. So that was good advice, but that wasn't what I wanted to do anyhow.
Had you talked at all to, in this period of late 1960, had you talked at all to any of the other co-founders?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. John and I talked.
Uh-huh.
John and Sheldon and I, that when we were taking our desert
mm-hmm.
exploring trips, we'd discuss this and say we're all going to leave. And because, you know, John especially was fairly volatile on this kind of a thing.
Were they both also did they too mourn the loss of the camaraderie and this hierarchy?
Oh yes,
that was the
mm-hmm.
the crux of it as it changed into this
yeah.
different entity.
Yeah, and we'd gotten whatever rewards we were going to get out of the company, we had gotten,
mm-hmm.
and the Fairchild management and its wisdom didn't see any reason to try to motivate us to stay there and be happy.
Hmm.
There's no concept of options or,
mm-hmm.
or sharing in the company or being involved in decision making. Noyce was over there, he was running around setting up the Italian division or whatever he was doing. And
right.
And I'd go down to the big production plant. It was just like visiting some foreign place. I had nothing, didn't know the people or had nothing to do with it.
Right.
Now, this is an inevitable thing with a growing company.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't. I was all of 30 then, and I had a lot of other stuff to do with my life, I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't made enough. This was not a big sum of money we got out of this. You know, it was 10 of us sharing $3 million, which
right.
is, at that time, my salary was probably 15 or 20,000, so it was like 15 years' pay.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't.
Yeah.
This is the venture capital payoff
yeah.
of today. Fairchild got a real bargain on that.
Mm-hmm.
They took an enormous risk for starting something new that nobody had done before.
Right.
And backing us completely, Hodgson in particular,
mm-hmm.
providing all the money we needed. And so, I mean, like any budget discussion that I was ever around, it was not, you can't spend all this money, it just document what you need it for. And the
yeah.
money was there.
Yeah.
Chairman Fairchild was interested, and Hodgson, as I say, was active. Mm-hmm. Carter was something else, but that was, he wasn't
mm.
at least impeding it. But.
Yeah. So, when did you and Hernie and Roberts start to talk about, did you start to decide that you wanted to work together again?
Lead yeah,
together?
Yeah, John and I in particular had established a very close, we shared
sure.
an office there. And,
okay.
And so we were on the same wavelength. John would do his technical thinking by himself, and he worked best when he was angry. He was motivated by being, I'll show the bastards, and go storming off, and then he'd come up with his one brilliant idea after another.
Could you talk a little bit more for a moment about him and his, what seems to me to be quite an amazing string of contributions that he made in quite a short period of mm-hmm. time, from the diffusion work that we talked about to the planar process, of course, but then also I think he was working on epitaxy at this time.
No, there was no work on epitaxy.
Oh, really?
Not until a couple later. Of years until later. He okay. worked on gold doping, where you could control the lifetime
okay.
and get devices a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very key advance, and I've, as I say, I've got his notebook entries on to discuss all this stuff.
Mm.
But we were, as I said, shared office and discussed technical things and back and forth.
Mm.
And we'd have lunch together very often. The conclusion to which he'd go buy a cheap, smelly cigar and smoke it in the office. And I said, "Jean, let me give you an extra 5 cents a day so you can get a somewhat higher quality cigar." Because he was a. As I wrote, after I learned he died, I couldn't sleep that night, and I sat and wrote the whole night long, and I wrote a pretty moving thing about my remembrance of him, about 10 pages,
mm-hmm.
which I later abstracted and gave a eulogy on, about his, the funny side of being associated with such a brilliant person.
And could you talk about, I mean, is that really the planar process was quite, I mean, that is his singular contribution.
Yeah.
Of just that enormous importance.
No, that's changed. It's made the integrated circuit possible. And it made the reliability of transistors greater. And
right.
ultimately improved the transistor yield. Without that, any of these later things wouldn't have been possible.
Hmm.
And again, like all these other structural inventions, the idea was not that difficult to come by. It was buckling down and building it,
mm-hmm.
which was the case with the integrated circuit.
Right.
And it was solving the technical problems. And it was sort of a, don't even bother with this, because the problem with, the major problem with transistors was surface contamination or leakages,
mm-hmm.
and the wisdom of the time was you have to strip all this dirty oxide off, which has been collecting all this crap underneath it, clean it off, and then mace it or do something else with it. And John, as I could see in his early ideas, didn't think that was right. His ideas, it went back to 57.
Mm-hmm.
And in 59, we started implementing. As I said, I helped build a mask for him. And he had one of these things built in 3 or 4 weeks. And then he demonstrated it to the staff there, and it was just flabbergasting how great this device was.
And that people had a real immediate sense of...
Immediate. There was no question about
yeah.
it. This is what we have to do.
Hmm.
And within a year, we had done it. And it led to, you know, better diodes. It led to...
So, at what point did... did you and he and Roberts decide to try and leave together, leave Fairchild together?
I could see that if we left together as three guys, the organizational structure would be difficult. So there was this three pretty independent guys, and so I had an agreement that I would, with Jean, and he and I would work together, and then we'd try to hire others. So Sheldon came in with us being in charge.
Okay.
And that didn't last all that long. He did it for a while we got Elko started.
Mm-hmm.
And Art Rock had been involved in, you know, early Teledyne financing, and so when he was, when I was down in LA for some meeting in July, I said, why don't you call Henry Singleton, George Klesmetsky, they're starting some new business. And I didn't get around to it and wasn't that interested. And so that just dragged on, and it was always, you call Henry, or say, Henry, you call Jay, and neither of us did it. And I remember very distinctly, this was just before we had our company Christmas party, that day, and I got a call, I think from Bud Coyle. He said, Henry, I called Henry, he's sitting at the end of the phone down there calling. And I did. And I was in a mood then that I was not big on Christmas parties and exchanging gifts and all that stuff. So I said, just count me out of getting a gift and I won't bother getting in this. And just at that time, they arranged that I was going to be the Santa that distributed all these. So I wasn't in a much of a company mood that day anyhow. And I called Henry, and this was just before Christmas. He said, why don't you come down to L.A. and we'll talk about this. So Jean and I went down, drove down New Year's Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to Henry the day before the New Year's. So I mean, to jump ahead a bit, we can go back and discuss some of the details of all this stuff, but we did indeed work out an agreement in fairly short order, and I left the end of January of 61.
Right.
The integrated circuit at Fairchild was an accomplished fact by then. But it was far from being turned into a production process.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel that I could take any of the integrated circuit group with me.
For what reason?
Just ethical reasons.
And, mm-hmm.
With the exception of Izzy Haas, it was announced that I was leaving. And Izzy came and he said, Jay, I don't know where you're going or what you're doing, going to do, but I quit too, and I'm coming along. So, so there, I obviously hired Izzy.
Right.
And as time went on, we, you know, gradually hired other people, but it was never. I got a letter from a standard letter from a lawyer, but there was never any. I was doing different stuff than Fairchild was doing, and I was still well thought of there, evidently. So there was never any legal problem.
Mm-hmm.
Until down the road, when the lawyers started looking at licensing or something like that.
Right.
I can tell you that story too if you remind me. But
well, when you were had you discussed, so was it from the time you went to MIT to give this series of lectures, was it sort of common knowledge among the other co-founders of Fairchild that you were thinking of doing something else?
No, I don't think so.
No.
I didn't share it with Gordon, had been the only one. And later in years, he said, I was sort of surprised when you said you were leaving. So I would have thought John would leave, but I didn't think you would. So he was sort of surprised when I announced this. So we said later.
Could you tell at the time, or how did the organization react when you announced that you were leaving?
Well, it wasn't an earth-shaking event. Some of my personal offense there. I'm one of the secretaries who was a receptionist. When every time I'd haul another box out, she'd start crying again. I think it was sort of inevitable. You say that there's just too much talent for this company, and it's turning into a big company run by sales and manufacturing and not technical innovation.
Right.
We've done our technical innovation, and all we need for a long time. And the innovation is going to be in
for the most part, in enlarging the dimension of devices we're making, you know, make a broader line, make we make 706 a lot smaller device. And but I mean, the challenge of just starting from scratch to do something nobody ever did before was over. And I toured the Intel plant down in Albuquerque a couple of years ago, and I said, my God, everything that they're doing here was stuff that we were doing.
Yeah.
I mean, no, with the exception of, you know, ion implantation and the epoxy, I mean, epitaxy, and some of that stuff, but the basic fundamental idea was the one that we introduced. That was an exciting thing to see.
Gratifying, I'm sure.
By the way, the degree of technical complexity flabbergasted me. I can't.
Right.
But it's just thousands of man years, just cracking it, cranking it down another notch every year or two. So, and I was had an incident with the marketing people that has been recounted in print someplace.
Yeah, and this is Tom Bay.
Tom Bay saying, "Last has pissed away $1 million on this. Why don't we just quit and close it down?"
Yeah, Bay was
understandable. I mean, I was going to take his customers away, and this is going to be a device that's going to be require a whole new concept of selling, and something nobody wanted. The customers didn't want it, and he didn't want to sell it, and. But, and this was probably in, I guess, October or something, before I went to my short trip to MIT. But, and nobody said anything. Just, all this stuff happened at the meeting, and nobody rose to my defense or said anything one way or the other.
Well, this was at a meeting with other folks.
Oh, this was with the whole, for some reason we got essentially the whole senior people together at one of our rare meetings, and there was, you know, a dozen people in the room or something like that. Tom came out with this blast, and started shrugging. Everybody shrugged, and I said, "I'm out of here." So, I have trouble putting together the timing on these various things, but an incident like that, you remember.
Do you think that was reflective of the general attitude that you maybe disagreed with, that, you know, the integrated circuits were just seen as quite a secondary concern?
Oh, it was quite a secondary concern. The state is quite a secondary concern for the next 4 or 5 years.
Right.
3 or 4 years. It was not a major. They tried making them, but it was sort of getting people's attention rather than making them in large quantities, I feel.
And you really wanted to get on with trying to do that.
I like that idea. In later years, I had dinner with Gordon, and I said, well, you know, this meeting sort of upset me. And Gordon made some comment, well, that was certainly a mistake I made not jumping into that. If you remembered much about it at all.
No, he did mention it in the interview. Yeah, it's sort of how he didn't know quite how he let that one get past him, you know.
So
he does remember that.
But that was a turning point for me, sir. And my relations with Gordon stayed just great, always.
What you still retain that very friendly relationship?
Yes, very friendly. And Gordon is outwardly easygoing and friendly, but I realize that he has an inward, a very determined agenda, but he will work at it as an easy a way as possible, not to take personal credit for it or anything else, but just wants to see it get done. I don't know if I'm expressing that very well. But
I understand what you're saying.
But he was... I can only remember one time when I had it. The only time I ever exchanged an angry word with him was we'd hired some hot shot from TI, was one to put TI organizational stuff into the company, and then the thing was turned out to be TI's greatest weakness rather than their greatest strength was all this, you know, reporting and setting up group goals and all that stuff. And Gordon took this and circulated it to all of us, and we were supposed to do it. And I just got incensed. I took this thing and rolled it up and took it in, threw it at him, and said, "You fill out this thing." And 10 minutes later, he was in my office, conciliatory, and